At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
So, Armin, this week it's, as they say in Mastermind, your specialist subject is...
Yes. Music. Ancient Greek music.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit later about how you and your contemporaries have uncovered, reconstructed and reproduced this music, which I've actually seen you do live in concerts, and it was absolutely fascinating. But before we get there, how was music used in ancient Greek? What was its purpose? How important was it?
It was incredibly important. So all the evidence, all the texts that we have, tell us that music was ubiquitous. It was used in the theatre to accompany the choruses. It was used in symposia, which were the elite parties that people held in their homes. It was used on the boats. The triremes were accompanied, the rows were accompanied by instruments giving them the beat, and so on. Pretty well everywhere you look, there's music.
Hmm. And what sort of instruments did they use for this music?
We talk about two main instruments, one of which is the most important instrument in the ancient world, probably the double pipe. It was called the aulos. Two pipes, double reeds.
Separate pipes?
Yeah, separate pipes.
Shoved in your mouth?
Shoved in your mouth together.
Right.
So that you have chords of two notes, you know, one on each pipe. And this instrument was played... We're told, initially by free men. So after the Persian Wars, that is in the 470s, this became less popular. And we're told that a professional musical class arose who could play this very difficult instrument very well. And so what you have are star pipers. There's a character called Pronymus of Thebes, and we're told that he... absolutely drove the audience wild with his facial expressions and the gyrations of his body as he played the double pipe. He was the Elvis Presley of the ancient world, gyrating around the stage, or the orchestra, as it's called, the dancing.
And whipping the audience into a frenzy.
Whipping the audience into a frenzy. They were cheering him on.
And is it hard to master this? You've got
the actual pipes are absolutely impossible to master, so right. There are a few wonderful experts. Famously, there's... a man called Callum Armstrong and another piper called Barnaby Brown, who have spent hundreds of hours.
And you've played with these people, haven't you?
I've given performances in which Barnaby and Callum have both performed on the aulos.
And do we have recordings of them?
And we have recordings, some of which we can hear. And we can hear wonderful sounds coming out of these pipes.
So who's playing on this?
This is Callum Armstrong on the double pipes.
Should we have a listen?
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That was who? That was
Callum Armstrong.
And the length of the breath seems to be almost inordinately inhuman. How do you keep it?
It's interminable. I mean, it's just going on and on. And that's because he's using a technique called circular breathing.
Explain
where
that.
You breathe in through your nose, you hold the breath in your cheeks, and you blow it out as you're playing, and you keep on breathing in through your nose and pushing it out through your mouth continuously. It's actually a very difficult technique. I've tried it many times. To practice, you have to blow continuously through a straw into a cup of water. Can you imagine? You want to get a continuous bubble.
Let's just give our audience a moment to go and get the straw.
Don't do this at home, you might suffocate. But I mean, what I tend to do when I try that is I go brrr,
yeah, yeah.
Brrr. But what he's doing is both at the same time. So he's breathing out and breathing in. And so the breath is being held and being pushed out. And that's the circular breathing
technique.
It's like
retraining your brain to do something it doesn't want to do, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a wonderful technique. But that is something that we're told about the ancient pipes, that they were this continuous
sound. So it was like a human bagpipe.
Very much like that, using your cheeks as the bag rather than a bag.
I came across a woman as well. There was when I was reading about this, Caryxena. Caryxena is referred to, she's a 5th century, and she plays the flute.
The flute, and what do we mean by the flute?
Well, I know what I mean by the flute.
Yeah, you mean a transverse.
So what would it be?
High-pitched sound. Now, the word flute has been used to translate our loss.
I mean, I'm getting this off Wikipedia. I'm not getting this
really?
from 10 years of being at Oxford, right. Armin. So don't raise your eyebrows at me. I'm just here down in the dirt trying to get some information for you. She says she was much lauded and compared to Sappho.
Right. Unfortunately, the word flute makes us think of a high-pitched transverse instrument. And our loss was not. As we know, it was held in the mouth, and there were two of them. So even though there's a singular word, our loss, it refers to this double pipe.
So they never play a singular pipe?
There was a transverse flute called the plagiaulos, but we don't know very much about who played it or where. What matters is that the most important popular instrument was this double pipe, and Caryxena no doubt played that. So when you say she played the flute, you mean she played the our loss. And that's because, apart from the professionals, there were essentially slaves, women who were high-class courtesans or slaves called auletrides, women who played the aulos, and they were the entertainers in symposia in elite men's parties.
Like the geishas, of course.
Like the geishas. Yeah. But these were highly skilled women who would be used in these parties. We don't know whether some of them could make money. They probably did get quite wealthy off it, some of them. So that although they were slaves, they perhaps had a way of collecting their money and maybe buying themselves out of slavery in due course.
And in other examples, like the performance of Greek plays, Greek tragedies in particular, the chorus would often be accompanied by the aulos, wouldn't they?
Yes, the chorus of Greek tragedy with 15 singers, they would have sung and danced it. In fact, the word chorus means dance.
Yes.
So they sang and danced. Now, the dance was probably not particularly energetic, because most of the choruses are dressed in long robes. We see that in vase paintings. Very often they're representing a chorus of women from the local town. So the dancing was possibly as much the upper body movements of the hand gestures and so on, rather than energetic
whirring around,
foot
yes.
movement.
But
there would have been movements of the feet, and in fact we have some amazing possible evidence for that in a very early papyrus with musical notation, which also has little flicks called stigmae, which means dots. And those flicks seem to occur on a regular basis in the course of the words of the music. So although the words themselves are quite agitated, they're in a rhythm which is very kind of fast and furious, the flicks, which indicate rhythmical movement, possibly of the feet or of the body, are fairly regular. So as you're going da, 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 da with your feet, you're going da, 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 da in your voice. So they could sing quite agitated words to music while moving in a fairly regular, slow way.
And this is for both tragedies and comedies.
Comedies had even larger choruses. They had 24 members of a chorus singing and dancing. And possibly they were more energetic. We hear more about legs up dance.
And don't you have a piece from The Frogs?
There's this wonderful moment in Aristophanes' play The Frogs where Dionysus is rowing across the lake to the underworld. This is Dionysus trying to get to the underworld in order to bring back a dead poet, because he says none of the poets alive today are any good. But in order to get there, he has to row across the river Styx. And he does so, and he finds that there are all these dead frogs, because, of course, this is in the underworld, who are causing him grief because he's rowing to a steady beat. And we have that, again, inscribed in the words of Greek. That steady beat is called iambic, and he's going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's an iambic dimeter, two iambs. And then the frogs, you see, the frogs actually are represented by the aulos player on the stage. And they would have been the chorus, dressed as frogs, so 15 men jumping around the stage, dressed as frogs, popping up, and they're going brekekekex, goax, goax, dum-di-dum-di-dum-di-dum. And that's called a trochaic rhythm, and that's interrupting his rowing. And he says, you know, I'm getting blisters trying to follow your beat. Will you shut up, you horrible, noisy frogs? And they're going, no, we won't, no, we won't. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And he's going, da-da-da-da-da-da, in his slow rowing, trying to beat them. And we can hear a bit of the aulos going, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
Was an amazing piece of
So that's a bit of improvisation by Callum trying to get the brekekekex aulos playing that rhythm, which is what they were doing, these frogs singing to the accompaniment of that aulos, interrupting Dionysus's slow rhythm. And he's saying, oh, shut up, you ghastly frogs. Eventually, what he does as he's rowing across the lake, and this is, I think, another very clever thing about the play, ancient rowers were accompanied by these aulosses because they have this rather penetrating sound. So you can hear them above noise and splashing and so on.
So to get the rhythm.
To get the rhythm of the rowing in the trireme, the cox was an aulos player. So this is what we're told. And they were guiding the rhythm. So we have to imagine that Dionysus in his boat, there's standing right beside him, or perhaps even in the boat, is the aulos player in the theatre. And he is guiding the frogs. Right. Brekekekex. And so what does he do to stop them? He grabs the aulos from the aulos player on stage.
Right.
And he says, now I've taken your song from you. And that bit of Greek had never been understood until we started seeing this as musical.
Ah, okay.
He says, to ti parhumin lambano, I'm taking this from you, he says. So he takes the pipes from the frogs and they say, what will we do now? You know, we've lost our music. They said, well, we'll just have to keep croaking. We'll croak and croak away and try and beat you that way. And he says, it's no good because I'll croak and croak away louder than you. And he wins that contest.
Right.
And he gets to the other side, rowing at his own speed.
That's fantastic.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
So that's the aulos, but what was the other main instrument used in ancient Greece that you referred to before?
That was the lyre.
Ah, the lyre.
The lyre, of course, a stringed instrument using arms and a bridge, and from the bridge to the sound board, which tends to be a tortoise shell, there are six or seven strings made of guts stretched across. Well, that lyre has a couple of standard forms, one of which is the kithara, which is the larger concert version of a lyre, rather fancy-looking instruments with large wooden sound boxes rather than a tortoise shell. And, of course, the kithara, as it was known in ancient Greek, is what gives rise to our word guitar via the Spanish guitarra. So imagine a pop star playing a love song accompanying him or herself on a guitar. We find vase paintings showing musicians, mainly men, in fact, playing these guitarra.
And were there pop stars? I mean,
yeah. We know about some pop musicians, some very successful musicians playing modern style songs in the 5th century BC. We have their names, people like famously Timotheus of Miletus, who came to Athens from Asia Minor, Miletus, and he wowed audiences by playing on an 11-stringed kithara and accompanying himself to songs that he created, of which one survives actually in some length, his piece called The Persians, and it describes in graphic sound detail how a Persian in the Battle of Salamis is drowning in the water.
And do you have any idea how long this musical performance would go on for? It's like, is it like a concept album kind of thing?
This particular piece may have gone on for a few minutes.
All right.
So we only have, most of what we have are the texts of the lyrics of musical pieces. And the word lyric, of course, comes from lyre.
And this is all secular music, or was it all to do with religious festivals?
Well, so what we have are the music that was played in symposia, which well have been secular songs, love songs, the songs of Sappho, or Anacreon. These are the lyric poets whose lyrics survive, but not the music, because they were active in, say, the 6th century BC. But the lyric poets, of which we have the lyrics, the words, they go back to, say, 650 BC. And we have to work out what the music might have sounded like. And one way of working it out is because the Greek language has natural pitches. So when you say a word in Greek, your voice goes up, and we're told by an ancient source that it went up within the interval of a fifth, so that's ba-ba, on certain bits of the word. So if you say the word good in ancient Greek, it's agathos, but actually the accent is on the last element of that word, so your voice would go agathos. You hear my voice rising in pitch at the last syllable, agathos. Now, if you set that to music, you might go da-da-dum. You might go up a fifth, or you might go up a fourth, or you might only go up one tone, da-da-dum, agathos. But either way, the melody is likely to conform to the word's own natural pitch profile. And the amazing thing is we have got these few dozen scores of ancient music, and when you do the statistics, around 70% of the melodization of the words conforms to the natural pitches. So considerable effort would be made to create a melody which fitted the natural pitches of the words.
Right, so in fact you were led by that, the music.
A musician would be. I mean, it makes sense. So if you're going to say agathos and your voice goes
unlike
up.
English, where unlike
English, where we don't have a pitch, so we can set it to anything.
Yeah.
They had a natural rhythm, so that word again is potentially short, short, long, da-da-da. That would then produce a rhythm for the...
You've composed music according to these rules,
yes,
haven't you? Can we hear a piece now?
Yeah, well, let's hear a piece composed by the singer Steph Connor, who recomposed music according to my instructions, using the principles that the voice goes up in melodic...
And leads the music.
But also applying the scales that we know from ancient times. They were given names, Dorian, Phrygian, and so on. And she has used Dorian and Phrygian scales, the notes of those scales, to go up and down to create a melodic line.
Okay, take it away, Steph.
Oh!
So, Armand, what possessed you to go down this road? I know you're a musician yourself, but how did you come to learn so much about ancient music? What gave you the kind of passion for it?
Yes, so I have learned the piano and cello from a very young age, and I have always been a practicing musician. But that and combined with my interest in classics led a lot of people to say to me for many years, you know, you're the person to try and reconstruct the sounds of ancient music. And I had a look at what evidence there was, and there was quite a bit of evidence. I mean, this is going back to the 80s. But I didn't feel it was enough to really give us a sense of what that music sounded like. And then in 1992, a great scholar, Martin West, published his book, Ancient Greek Music. And in it, he gathered together all the documents and essentially all the evidence for ancient music and did everyone a huge service because there were then about 60 fragments of scores. And that's something that people don't realize, that the ancient Greeks had created a notation which we can read as musical notation. So he collected those and he transcribed those scores into modern stave.
But how similar are they to...
Very different. So it's not like our notation. What the Greeks did is they used two systems, one for the voice and one for instruments, and the vocal notation was essentially the Greek alphabet. Simple principle that the higher in the alphabet, the higher the note. Mm-hmm. So let's say you start with an A, an alpha, and it's da, then you have a beta. Now, the beta is not a tone below it. It's either a quarter tone or a half tone. You actually have three letters, alpha, beta, gamma, that span a particular note and variants of that.
How do you know that?
Because we're told in enormous detail, right. And that's the other thing. We never didn't know what the ancient system was about. What we didn't have was a lot of scores, right. But we have ancient treatises and books about how the musical notation works. So we have tremendous explanations of the melodic system, of what the early modes were. So the modes were like systems of notes which you would tune a lyre to. Now, we know that we believe that, you know, we can say middle C is at this particular pitch. A is Hertz 440. That's because in the 19th century, Hertz came up with this way of measuring sound waves, and a particular pitch is at a particular set of waves, and the Hertz pitch, A equals 440 or whatever, is what we go with. Now, they didn't have that in the ancient world, but they had a sense that there was a central pitch. I mean, this is what's so interesting about the notation system, that there is a central pitch, however it is pitched, and from there, one can then look at the intervals and say there's a tone, semitone, tone, or whatever, and you can create a scale. So people are fussed about the notion about, but if they didn't have a particular note, bar, which was, you know, the central pitch note, how do we know how to form a scale? The answer, it doesn't matter what that central tonic note is. You can pitch it within a small interval. I mean, they undoubtedly didn't pitch it at the same place any more than up until the 19th century. That was the case with almost all music. So when you tuned to an A, it might be an organ A, but we know from organ pipes from Bach's time that some were tuned much higher and some were tuned much lower. So an A wasn't necessarily a fixed pitch. And that's certainly the case in the ancient world. You had instruments which might set a pitch, and that would then be taken and the singers would sing to that pitch. In a different city-state, you might have a different... Remember, these things were not standardized. You might have a different instrument with a slightly lower A. But the point is, they had a sense that there was a central tonic note, and from that, you worked out the intervals of the scales, and those intervals are given to us with precise explanations, because a great mathematician and musician in the 2nd century AD, Ptolemy, wrote treatises on maths and on harmonics, and he gives us the intervals that are created by different notes.
So one of the natural themes of what we talk about is to kind of debunk this feeling about the ancient world, that it's very distant from us, because clearly, temporally, there's quite a few years. But in terms of the culture, and the ideas and the themes, they kind of resonate down the years and we pick them up in the modern day. I mean, we wouldn't have modern music without this, the provenance of the ancient world's efforts.
I think that's right. So until recently, it was thought that Western music begins in around the 9th or 10th century with something called Gregorian plain song. And that was brought over in psalms from Hebrew liturgy, and the melodies were transferred to Western music. And there's a fairly straight line from Gregorian song through to Renaissance music and through to modern music. But what about the music that came before that? It's generally been thought to have been rather alien. But, of course, there was 1,000 years of the Roman world. And where did the Romans get their music from? They got them from ancient Greece. So the only Roman music we have are bits of ancient Greek music written in Roman times, for example, by Messimedes, who was Hadrian's freedman. So we can, I think, now say, of course, these musical traditions that survived into the Roman period also influenced the way music sounded in the 9th and 10th centuries and are very much the basis of Western music. And of course, a lot of the words that we use, the word for a tone, tonos, it's a Greek word, the word for music that's played together, symphonia becomes our word symphony, harmonia means the, it's a Greek word for an attunement of different strings that work together. Melody, of course, is melodia, and so on. So these are all Greek words. So Greek underlies our whole understanding of music, and not least because what's really interesting about this music is that it has the same sensibility as Western music. So when it's sad, it's slow and dejected. When it's upbeat, it's in major key, and you don't get that in Indian or Japanese or Balinese traditions. So the fact is, this is Western music already in ancient Greece, and it has got to have come through that 1,000 years of Roman Empire.
Well, thanks, Armin. I felt that was a bit of a masterclass. So if you imagine you're on an ancient desert island discs, right? So there you are, you're cast away, and of all the music that you've composed and that you've had some dealings with these fantastic Aulus players, which piece would you take to your desert island?
Well, I'd probably take the Brekka Kekex that Callum is playing because it would cheer me up.
Right.
But one of the pieces I think is important to talk about is the chorus from Euripides' Orestes, which was staged in 408 BC. And we have this amazing bit of papyrus. It's about 2 inches square, on which we have a bit of that chorus written and the melodic notation, which tells us how it might have been sung. Now, there are gaps in that, and I spent some time working out how those gaps might have been filled. So we know what the scale is that is used. It's the Phrygian mode. So we know what the notes would have been. We have an understanding of the principles of composition, and so we could fill that in and create something that sounds like sung music. And I did that for a video which has actually gone viral on YouTube, over 1 million listeners, called Rediscovering Ancient Greek Music, because I did that in 2017. And since then, a group in Oxford of students put on a wonderful performance in November 2024 of the whole of Euripides' Orestes, and they recomposed music for all the choruses on similar principles. It was a marvellous sense of being in an ancient theatre with a full chorus singing and dancing, and you had that music recomposed according to ancient principles. So I would want to hear, at least put in my important pieces of ancient music that we want to hear, the chorus from Euripides' Orestes that survives on that scrap of papyrus and can be reconstructed to sound something like the music they would have heard at the time.
Armin Dangle, thank you for your Desert Island discs. Let's hear it.
It's All Greek and Latin to Me is presented by Armin Dangour and Jimmy Melville. The The producer is Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. It's All Greek and Latin to Me is a Hattrick podcast.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a mention to Classics for All. Classics for All is a charity, and what we want to do is provide access to the classics to as many state school pupils as possible. Alongside training teachers who don't actually have to have any previous training in the subject, they hope that they make classics a sustainable part of the school curriculum. If you want to find out more about this fantastic charity, go to the website. It's www.classicsforall.org.uk.